Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please? Are interpreters ready? Good. I am afraid, before we really begin, I have several announcements to make. We are already 25 minutes behind the schedule, and we have a list of 14 speakers for the whole of the afternoon session. It means that we'll have to stick very strictly to the time frame, 10 minutes per speaker maximum, and I'll enforce that with the activity of an army sergeant. Secondly, we'll break for coffee around 4 p.m. because nothing is as important as coffee. And continue after lunch with the remaining speakers. Everyone who is registered, of course, will have a chance to speak. Having said that, I'm passing into the Russian language to continue moderating this session. Открываем.
Okay, let us open the second session of our conference, and it is my pleasure to give the floor to Mr. Osman Khalid Mudawi, Chairman of Committee for International Affairs of the Sudanese Parliament. Добрый день, дамы и господа. Добрый день, дамы и господа.
For their kind invitation, with a special thanks to Mr. Marglov, who made this whole event possible. And also, I must thank all the participants who took the trouble of traveling to Moscow to participate in this session. After so many speakers dealing in a very scholarly manner with the various intricate problems attending the Sudanese condition, it is hard to add much to what they have said. But what I really, my message which I would like to deliver loud and clear is that the Sudan is very anxious to solve its various problems. The CPA itself must be considered as a landmark in the history of conflict resolution. The discussion, the deliberations went for a couple of years, and sometimes the main parties, the negotiations in Nifasha, continued for a stretch of 9 months non-stop. So it was an awesome achievement by any standard. And anybody who reads that documents will concede that the Sudan went the extra mile in order to reach a settlement. Sudan actually put its unity at risk for the sake of peace. So a country that did all that, to find itself subsequently and very shortly after the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in accusation of starting another war for itself in the other end of the country, in the western most part of Sudan, therefore, is hard to believe. But that was exactly happened. As soon as, before the ink dried up in the Nifasha Accord or the Nairobi Agreement, because it was signed in Nairobi, and just after the meeting in Oslo, which promised everything for Sudan and for the south and the north after the signing of the accord, then the world media unleashed, which by any standard can be considered the most ferocious media campaign ever witnessed, at a time when far more far worse problems were happening elsewhere. It was during the time, it was contemporary to the invasion of Iraq and the invasion of Afghanistan, which preceded it, that therefore was put on the fast track to become overnight the worst possible humanitarian disaster in the whole world. It was not difficult for us to understand the motives of the people who waged this campaign. Some wanted to divert attention from the terrible humanitarian disaster unfolding in Iraq, which nobody, people tried to play with numbers in the Darfur conflict without any reference, without any scientific basis for the numbers they were quoting. We started hearing 100,000 dead, 200, 300, 400,000, and so forth. This was a media ploy just meant to produce maximum negative impact about Sudan. And what was happening elsewhere of the world did not receive the same media coverage, which was far worse in dimension, in scope, in intensity, and in the real humanitarian disasters that that it brought in its train. You ask anybody now, does anyone know the real body count of the people who died in Iraq? And a conservative estimate would be 1 million. The people displaced outside Iraq, 4 million. And inside Iraq, about 2 million. Not to mention the total destruction of Iraq. Their life as they knew it suddenly vanished and disappeared before their ear, before their eyes. I'm not going to mention much about Afghanistan. That terrible saga is still continuing in its seventh year. And not just one country. The United States and all other NATO countries are participating and sending troops. I don't want to divert your attention from Sudan to discuss what is happening in Afghanistan. But I just want to make a passing reference to what is happening in that country. And in, from my opinion, in my book, it is one of the most immoral wars in history. Trying to destroy a whole nation by pretending that they are sponsoring international terrorism. These are just fabrications. Anyway, Sudan, I just mentioned that it did everything in its power to reach a peaceful settlement, to settle the South-North conflict. And I assure you that it has the same level of dedication to come to an end to the Darfur conflict. First of all, let us agree certain principles. What is the duty of any government? The duty of any government, the number one duty, is to preserve peace and order. If someone declared war on the government, if someone mounted armed attacks on peaceful citizens, what is the duty of that government regarding its own citizens? Is it not the simple, basic duty of protecting them? We did nothing more, and we did nothing less. Our government, whatever it did, which is known to you as an armed conflict, was the exercise of its normal duty as a government to bring bandits to book. And surprisingly enough, people who gave themselves the right to fight across the world, fighting, defending their national security 5 or 8,000 miles away from home, cannot understand our need to safeguard our own citizens and defend them against terrorist attack in our own country. They can do it in Afghanistan, 7,000 miles away, and bring all their friends from Europe to fight with them. But we cannot, we should not, we must not do the same in our own country. What kind of logic is this? What kind of morality is this? So, Sudan, we were forced, our hands were forced to, now, for example, everyone now is concerned about the peacekeepers who have been kidnapped and abducted in Darfur. It is an act of terrorism. And everyone would like the government to do its very best to apprehend the perpetrators of that act. Fine, we do not disclaim our responsibility. We will do it, and we'll do everything in our power to do it. But that's exactly what we have been doing. It becomes very important because the victims are non-Sudanese, because they are Europeans or Africans or Pakistanis who are components of the International Peace Force. If they are Sudanese, does the crime become any less heinous, any less worthy of being repelled, of being dealt with? I believe that we should not have double standards. We believe that the basic duty of governments must never be overlooked. And if someone using their powerful media would like to project a different point of view, that's something which the only thing we can do about it is try to articulate as far as we can what we can do to repel that kind of attack. But I would like to reiterate, like what all my friends have said before me, Dr. Ghazi and Motrif Siddiq, that the Sudan is very keen to bring the whole country, to pacify the whole country, to fulfill its, all its commitments under the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. And incidentally, the difficulties which are now the country is facing in the implementation of the peace agreement is not our own making. It is just, our partners to the peace agreement are dragging their feet. We are doing everything in our power to cajole them, to make them, to persuade them that we should implement the peace agreement in the interest of everybody. All the difficulties attending to the census, for example, the census. Who performed that census? It was the sole duty of the government of South Sudan to conduct the census under international supervision. They are the one who did it, with no intervention whatsoever from the government in Khartoum. And then when the result of the census was not to their liking, they said that they cannot recognize it. So we would like the international community to participate in the art of persuasion, to tell them that there is no way that you can refute the results of a census which was conducted by your own people. It is unfair. So these are things which we must, all of us, agree that Sudan needs the help of the international community to put some kind of pressure on our partners with the peace agreement to make them comply with that agreement. I have been advised that my time has been exhausted, and since my time has been exhausted, the only thing I can say, we all as Sudanese hope for the best. We would appreciate very much the help of the international community, and the kind of help like some people suggested here that would like us to deal positively with the ICC, that is the kind of help we don't need. We are the sovereign government. Our parliament passed a resolution unanimously ordering our government not to deal with the ICC. And I assure you that nobody in the Sudan would flout the authority, the sovereignty, and the ruling of our parliament. Thank you very much.
Спасибо, господин Мусави. Я должен защищать интересы.
Thank you very much. I am here to protect the interests of all the speakers, and I know it's very hard to tell the representatives of Sudan that their time is out because the speeches made by Sudanese representatives are of special interest to us. Now let me give the floor to Mr. Hatik Gilan, the ambassador of Turkey.
Giving me the floor. I shall try to be as brief as I can. If I'm a little bit longer, this is due to the collateral damage caused by the magnificent lunch hosted by our Russian colleagues. Now, at the outset, let me express my gratitude to the Institute of Modern Development for organizing this conference on the Sudan, a key country in Eastern Africa with which Turkey entertains relations for more than four centuries. Naturally, I should like to pay my tribute to Mr. Mikhail Margalov, with whom I had the opportunity to meet in his visit to Khartoum in the capacity of Special Representative of the President of the Russian Federation for Sudan, for supporting this scientific conference in search of future perspectives in the settlement of the Darfur crisis and challenges in the region at large. It's indeed an honor to be amongst other prominent figures in the podium and the audience who either deploy efforts for or contribute to finding political and peaceful means of resolving crises in the African continent. I hope that this conference dedicated to the Sudan with a focus on the Darfur crisis will yield new insights and renewed impetus in tackling a wide array of crises and conflicts inflicting the continent. I'm sure that the speakers and participants in this conference are aware of the fact that Turkey has a vast historical background in terms of its relations with the Sudan, dating back to the 16th century. Against the backdrop of this deeply rooted relationship, Turkey has always followed with keen interest the developments in the Sudan stemming from the common history between the two countries. It's not my aim to delve into the historical annals and nitty-gritties of this long relationship, but it should be kept in mind that our historical reflexes and reflections are set in motion whenever and wherever issues related to the Sudan are discussed. Consequently, the Moscow Conference is indeed very seminal as far as we are concerned. Having spent almost 4 years in the Sudan as the Turkish ambassador, I have certainly read and analyzed a whole host of documents, resolutions, reports, scientific essays, news articles, what have you. Although outlooks may change from each evolving contingency, there must certainly be a realistic situational awareness of what the crises in the Sudan mean. Composed of tribes extending up till Nigeria into the far west, Chad, DRC, and CAR in the near west and southwest, Uganda in the south, Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Somalia in the east, the Sudanese society and its state apparatus are certainly facing problems radiating from beyond its borders. Intra and intertribal conflicts and reconciliations have always been part and parcel of Sudan. Hence, there is a domestic facade of crises which must be addressed through the use of conventional methods familiar to the local communities. However, the regional aspect of these conflicts is one of the driving forces that need constant attention. Many argue that certain circles, particularly a number of lobby groups operating elsewhere, who claim to understand and analyze the gist of the Sudan case, disconnect themselves from the harsh realities unfolding in the country and frustrate those watching and analyzing events and the region under the banner of lofty ideals, which we all share and advocate. Such perceptions must be avoided, and peace-orientated efforts must be at the driving seat. In this respect, recent initiatives and efforts at states level should be welcomed and encouraged. The recent statement issued by the envoys of the 5 permanent members of the Security Council and the envoy of the European Union to the Sudan on the 27th of May 2009 in Doha is, in my opinion, a solid foundation on which to build peace and reconciliation in the Sudan. Crises in the Sudan have also been on the agenda of many international actors and institutions for a long period. There have been numerous decisions taken by the United Nations, African Union, and other regional organizations to surmount the challenges faced by the Sudan. From time to time, the focus has shifted towards different aspects of the same situation, thereby engendering diverse resolutions and initiatives. However, although these efforts and initiatives have produced some useful results, they have not yet prepared the grounds for the necessary synergy for peace and stability in the Sudan. The primary reason for such an outcome is, in the main, the lack of a holistic view, embracing and melting the different aspects of the same crisis inflicting various regions in the Sudan and beyond. What I allude to here is the need for a coordinated strategy that binds together all the relevant data and firmly proceeding on the basis of such a strategy. I'm pleased to observe recently the emergence of such a cooperative and coordinated approach, which is in the making and should remain inclusive in nature. Having said this, and with due respect to regional efforts concentrated on various local and regional challenges, I cannot but still doubt whether some of those peace-oriented endeavors have been able to balance contestation and competition with cooperation and consensus. Traces of diverging attitudes coupled with local, regional, and international agendas, both from within and outside, coupled with local, regional, and international agendas, both from within and outside, do compound peace efforts and do not serve the purpose of attaining peace. Emotive predilections and prejudices married to different interests and interest groups, be they in the political or legal domains, also play their role as impediments to peace and stability in the Sudan. It could be argued that peace processes related to the Sudan should primarily be promoted and encouraged, particularly by the African countries, which in practice means that the ownership of such endeavors is of the utmost importance. This is true and constitutes a fundamental principle in solving conflicts. Be that as it may, we should recall the whole gamut of decisions and resolutions taken by the African Union concerning the explicit need for capacity building with a view to effectively solving African problems by Africans themselves. In this regard, we should ask ourselves whether our efforts geared towards capacity building in Africa are sufficient. While addressing challenges faced by the Sudan, we should all bear in mind that no single country can facilitate the resolution of the ongoing crises in the Sudan. Therefore, concerted and cooperative efforts reinforced by a holistic approach supported by the international community are essential. Challenges in Africa, and particularly in the Sudan, seem overwhelming and necessitate sophisticated and unrelenting efforts, taking into account the following view, which I have borrowed from a quote in the Commission report I have earlier referred to. I'm talking about the African Union Commission report, as follows. That is 31st of August 2009 in Tripoli. No single internal factor has contributed more to the present socio-economic problems in the continent than the scourge of conflicts within and between our countries. They have brought about death and human suffering, engendered hate and divided nations and families. Conflicts have forced millions of our people into a drifting life as refugees and internally displaced persons, deprived of their means of livelihood, human dignity, and hope. Conflicts have gobbled up scarce resources and undermined the ability of our countries to address the many compelling needs of our people. That decision or that observation was made back in 1993. As for my country, our position is being guided by what has been adopted at the Africa-Turkey Cooperation Summit held in Istanbul on 21st of August 2008. Among the fundamental principles enunciated in the summit declaration, it has been emphasized inter alia that Turkey's relations with Africa will be guided by respect for the principles of the UN Charter, the Constitutive Act of the AU, the five principles of peaceful coexistence, and other universally recognized principles governing relations among states, and adherence to the principle of respect for state sovereignty and territorial integrity, as well as avoidance of the abuse of the principle of universal jurisdiction. I underline once again, the avoidance of the abuse of the principle of universal jurisdiction. Furthermore, Turkey's attitude and experience in terms of humanitarian and developmental assistance in the Sudan targets to mitigate, within her means, the adverse consequences of conflicts as underlined in the AU Commission report. From Turkey's perspective, NGO activities in the field should not be limited in form and scope to solely alleviating famine and to providing immediate health care for the deprived. Projects and activities conducted by NGOs and international civil society operating in the Sudan must embrace a long-term approach and be more comprehensive in terms of preparing the social as well as physical conditions which enable ex-IDPs to reintegrate to the society and reconstruct their livelihoods. This mind frame is inherent in the activities of Turkish International Cooperation and Development Agency, that's called TICA. Turkish NGOs active in various regions of the Sudan and the Turkish Red Crescent Society operating not just in Darfur, but throughout the Sudan. Allow me to elaborate briefly my point by referring to a few examples. Since the year 2006, more than 2,000 Sudanese police personnel have been trained by the Turkish police forces. The immense number of trainees aside, the focus in the training programs has been on contributing to social policing skills of the Sudanese police, which we see as essential for maintaining the holistic approach to security. The Turkish Field Hospital in Niala, supported by Turkish official institutions as well as a number of Turkish NGOs, which has been offering free healthcare in a wide range of medical fields, is currently being transformed into a permanent hospital to be used also for training Sudanese doctors and nurses in Darfur. The Juba Training Hospital. 3 units of this hospital have been equipped and restored to their operative capacity by the Turkish Ministry of Health. Moreover, a model village project in Darfur carried out by a Turkish NGO comprises all infra and superstructures designed to provide facilities and physical conditions needed by an ideal mid-sized village's inhabitants. In this framework, the aim of this project is not only to establish a model facilitating the safe return of IDPs in the surrounding areas to their homes, but to prepare the grounds for enhanced social environment suited for the needs of its future inhabitants. Now comes the conclusions. I do not have the ambition to recommend a course to chart for overcoming the challenges for a friendly country, namely Sudan, nor to produce a recipe to follow to end once and for all the crises in the Sudan. But I do have a number of humble proposals to make that could make a modest contribution to the ongoing peace efforts. In my opinion, the time has become ripe for producing a framework for peace in the Sudan in the run-up to general elections in April 2010 and the referendum in 2011, the milestones in CPA. This window of opportunity must be seized and the momentum recently created must be preserved. Priority must be given without delay to reviving Darfur-Darfur dialogue, and this process should be all-inclusive, utilizing the conventional methods in solving crises in the Sudan, which involves local community leaders, tribal chiefs, elderly commission or councils, and certainly the nascent bits and pieces of civil society in the region. This is what I see as the civil society in Darfur. I think we should have a clear definition of what civil society is in Darfur when we talk about the involvement of civil society in the peace negotiations to be carried out in Doha at the end of this month. Sudan's People's Initiative must be re-energized, expanded, substantiated, and implemented in full as soon as possible. A clear political will must be displayed to implement this important endeavor. The tripartite mechanism established through efforts of Mr. Scott Gratian must remain alive even after the settlement of issues between NCP and SPLM throughout the election period and the referendum in the South. Peace negotiations under the aegis of Qatar should continue to be supported by the international community. Efforts deployed by Mr. Jibril Basole need also to be encouraged and supported by all stakeholders. Endeavors to unify the rebel groups should be relentless and continue in the aftermath of a possible peace deal to see through its implementation. Every effort must be spent to normalize relations between Chad and the Sudan, and a more effective monitoring mechanism should be established at the border between the two countries. Recommendations of the High Panel on Darfur, headed by the former President of South African Republic, Honorable Thabo Mbeki, should be heeded. UNSC members should harmonize and unify their positions before 2010. To achieve further progress in improving peace and stability in the Sudan. That means the end of the year, this year. Political will expediency and pragmatism are all necessary to overcome the impasse prevailing in United Nations Security Council. Special envoys and those who are willing and able should convene more regularly to assess developments in the Sudan with a view to harmonizing and reinforcing local, regional, and continental initiatives.
Mr. Gilan, excuse me.
I'm finishing. Okay. Two more paragraphs. Any peace-oriented solution in the Sudan must be supported with a financial package in the form of humanitarian and developmental assistance and must be linked to solid projects making a difference in the field. Hence, a new and focused structure with a clear and verifiable mandate endorsed by United Nations Security Council based on consultations with local authorities and leaders is necessary for the NGOs operating in the field. Challenges we all have to face now and in the future are so high and intricate in nature that mutually reinforcing and interlocking multi-track, multilateral efforts are indispensable, which should take their cues from the successful past deals and agreements. Thus, there is no need to invent the wheel, but to take it as a starting tool to chart the new course. Thank you very much for your patience and attention.
Спасибо. Пожалуйста.
And now I would like to give the floor to Mr. Stefano Montecoro from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Italy.
EU representatives are before me, and we are effectively all on the same line. First of all, I wish to express my most sincere gratitude to the Russian Federation, President Margalef, and the co-organizers for having organized this meeting. Italy values the active involvement of Russia in the international community's efforts to contribute to the stabilization of Sudan and looks with interest at the innovative approach of this conference. It's okay, I'm not in a hurry. We are extremely committed to Sudan, and like others, we deem the implementation of the CPA as a paramount for the stability and prosperity of this country. As highlighted by different speakers and in different occasions, NCP and SPLM bear the responsibility to implement the CPA, taking into account the deadlines set in the agreement. However, we cannot ignore that the implementation of the CPA has been delayed, and that in the next 15 months, a very short period of time compared to the initial provision, general elections and a crucial referendum are foreseen. A clear vision of the future of Sudan is needed to prepare properly these critical steps, and it is up to the signatories of the CPA to agree on this vision. We have heard this morning a number of Sudanese personalities, and what they said was very refreshing from this viewpoint. NCP and SPLM must set the requirements of the future unity of the country or the future independence of South Sudan in order to allow the voters to choose. Hence, it is of utmost importance, in our opinion, that the two parties agree now on post-2011 arrangements. Defining a post-referendum framework must be a process parallel to the implementation of the CPA, as it will help create the right environment for the implementation of the remaining provisions of the peace agreement. The international community, on its part, bears a responsibility to establish an environment conducive to such an agreement and to contribute to its implementation, not leastly through honoring pledges. With regard to Darfur, we call for an inclusive peace process with the participation of all relevant stakeholders, government of Sudan, armed movements, civil society organizations, IDPs, traditional leaders. The solution to the crisis cannot be but political, as said before, and it must address the root cause of the conflict, preferably within a united national framework. The solution must foresee a fair wealth and power sharing. It must answer the request for justice, and it must reconcile Sudanese people. We appreciate the current efforts to reunite the fragmented Darfurian rebel factions under a single umbrella in view of the peace negotiations with the Sudanese government, but the various initiatives in this field must be harmonized. We particularly value the Qatari initiative in this sense and are very grateful for the efforts and the headway being made. Clear and coordinated messages must be sent to the government of Sudan, the rebel movements, and the people of Darfur. We thus call on the main international actors to empower the AU-UN mediation and support its efforts. And I see this occasion to renew Italy's full support to the Joint Chief Mediator, Mr. Bassolet. Finally, the commitment of regional actors remains necessary to settle the crisis, and in particular, the normalization of the relations between Sudan and Chad is of primary importance for a viable peace in Darfur. The two countries must implement the existing agreements, and the international community, together with the Dakar contact group, must put them squarely in front of their responsibilities. That's all.
Спасибо, господин Монтекурво. Пожалуйста, господин Дэвид Мазерский, фонд Humanity United.
Mr. Mazursky, Humanity United.
The Russian government and Special Envoy Margelov for convening this important conference and for providing me the opportunity to speak. Sudan is facing an unprecedented set of challenges in the coming 15 months, and there exists a realistic risk of a return to large-scale war. There's a shrinking timeline before the end of the CPA and a number of major implementation benchmarks outstanding, which are increasingly contested. There are also a worrying number of indicators that the situation in Sudan is heading in the wrong direction. These include the increased violence in the south and the SPLM leadership's public accusations of NCP support to southern militias. The recent increase in fighting in Darfur combined with the extended delays in that peace process, and increasing polarization over whether elections should be held in April and under what minimum conditions. International engagement in Sudan should be driven first and foremost by a common effort to avoid a return to large-scale war and to promote a sustainable peace. To accomplish this, the international community will need to achieve two things. First, find a way to improve coordination and collaboration on a common agenda for a comprehensive peace in Sudan. This will require a commitment to consistently uphold decisions and hold the parties accountable to their promises, something which has been lacking in the past. It's also important to highlight the interconnectedness of Sudan's conflicts. There must be an all-Sudan peace, or the next war could be a truly national civil war. Second, that the agenda must be sufficiently long-term to address the challenges up to and beyond 2011, and should seek to address the root causes of conflict in Sudan. International engagement should be guided by three main policy priorities over the coming period. First, a peaceful and sustainable resolution of the Darfur conflict. Second, supporting national-level government reform and a genuine democratization process, with elections being only one part of that process. Third, supporting CPA implementation, specifically the run-up and transition around the 2011 I'll use the rest of my time to focus in more detail on the referendum and the critical importance of a free and fair referendum taking place on time. I believe the referendum is the only non-negotiable red line in the CPA, and its delay or manipulation will inevitably lead to a return to war. Therefore, if our primary goal is to prevent such a return to large-scale war, then the international community must act to ensure that the steps leading up to the referendum, such as the referendum law, are resolved quickly and amicably. We must remember that a call for self-determination became a driving force behind the civil war, though not the only driving force, and that the referendum was part of the fundamental trade-off in the Machakos Protocol on which the CPA was eventually built. Efforts are needed to work towards mutually beneficial arrangements for post-2011 scenarios, should the South vote for secession, recognizing this is a likely outcome. Put another way, there are significant risks for renewed conflict around the referendum, so long as it is perceived as a zero-sum event by the parties. Promoting unity at all costs is one way to deal with these conflict risks, but will lead back to war by a different path. Instead, these risks can be mitigated or reduced by supporting mutually beneficial arrangements on some of the specific issues that arise from a potential Southern secession vote, thereby changing perceptions from zero-sum to win-win. Among the main issues that must be negotiated in this scenario include cross-border oil revenue sharing and pipeline rental arrangements, water rights, finance and currency, division of assets and liabilities, status of internally displaced and citizenship questions, and security arrangements. The international community can help in the search for mutually beneficial solutions to these issues. And let me suggest that this provides a unique opportunity for Russia and China in particular to positively engage. Russia's recent history following the dissolution of the Soviet Union provides a relevant set of examples and experiences that are directly relevant to the Sudan context. With regard to oil revenue sharing and pipeline rental arrangements, Russia is party to at least three different oil and gas pipeline arrangements which have experienced changes in sovereignty over the course of their existence: the Druzhba pipeline, the Atarau-Samara pipeline, and the CAC pipeline. How are these three cases managed? Are there lessons that are applicable to the Sudan context? With regard to citizenship rights and national populations across borders, there are early warning signs that the southern population in the north could come under significant pressure and possibly face violence or forcible displacement should the south vote for secession. This is a potentially disastrous scenario which should be avoided at all costs. What lessons, both positive and negative, can be learned from the breakup of the Soviet Union and the Russian diaspora in the newly independent former Soviet republics with regard to different options for rights, protections, and citizenship granted to Russian minority populations, management of returning populations, and the role for third-party actors such as UNHCR. Alternatively, does the current Four Freedoms Agreement between Sudan and Egypt offer a precedent that could be replicated to protect minimum rights of southerners in the north and northerners in the south? With regard to finance and currency, are there applicable lessons from the experience of the ruble zone, which followed the wave of independence in the early 1990s? With regard to security arrangements in Sudan, the SPLA has a significant number of northerners in its ranks, just as the Sudan Armed Forces has a considerable number of southern troops. What was the experience of the Red Army with regard to nationals of newly independent states who found themselves across borders? These examples are directly relevant to the challenges ahead for Sudan, but also demonstrate that each of these issues have concrete solutions. Russia's unique history can provide an important contribution to the peaceful management of these issues in the Sudan context. China, too, has an important role to play in these discussions. As the single largest investor in Sudan's oil sector and the single largest shareholder in the Greater Nile oil pipeline, China has the opportunity to help usher in and support an agreement on post-2011 oil sector cooperation between North and South, a critical component for a peaceful and sustainable transition. With specific regard to a potential pipeline arrangement, the UNDP and the World Bank have identified four best practices for international pipelines. First, that the rules are clearly defined and accepted. Second, that projects are driven by commercial interests. Third, that there are credible threats to deter obsolescent bargaining. And fourth, that there are mechanisms to create a balance of interests. China is uniquely placed to help support mechanisms on these last two criteria: credible threats to deter obsolescent bargaining and mechanisms to create a balance of interest. For example, would the Chinese government consider acting as a guarantor for any post-2011 pipeline rental arrangement or broader North-South oil revenue sharing pact? Its privileged role in Sudan's oil sector would make it well-suited for this task, which in turn could promote continued stability in Sudan's oil sector to the benefit of Northern and Southern Sudan, the transitional areas, and China and other investors in the oil sector. I hope these ideas can be the spark for future conversation. Thank you for your time.
Спасибо, господин Мозерский. Я задумался над вашими вопросами.
Thank you very much, and I thought it over what you said, and I thought about the experience of the ex-USSR in terms of Sudanese problems we're tackling today.
Appreciate being invited to participate in this workshop. I think it is imperatively, it is very important to comment on the last speech given by my colleague who is sitting on my left hand. He has already divided Sudan into two states, the north and the south. Really, you are eligible to be appointed the advisor of the new state in future. He went completely astray, and he started imagining problems which might be in the horizon between the north and the south if Southern Sudan succeeded. Gentlemen, will work hard for unity, because the SPLM has no intention to secede from the north. This is one of the ABCs of the CBA. Will work hard for the unity of the nation. I will reply to him by quoting from Macbeth, from his tragedy Macbeth, from Shakespeare, I'm sorry. He said, come what come may, time and hour run through the roughest day. Where shall we meet again? In thunder, like tearing or a rain, where the hairy berry is done when the battle is lost and won. Don't be in a hurry. I have respect for Russia. But I want to tell my fellow Russians that they have inherited a huge burden from the Soviet Union. Millions of Africans, they came here to Russia. They have their education during the Soviet Union, free of charge. He said, we have friends in Africa. No, you have millions of friends, sons and daughters for Russia in Africa. We are very loyal to Russia because we have our education here. We have lived, but now when I came back after 40 years, I have to pay for my hotel. Previously, no, I am an African. I don't pay. I don't pay for my hotel. I don't pay for the buses, and I don't pay for my education. We have enjoyed Russia at the time. And I am sure that new Russia will stand with Africa, will stand with us, will defend our rights. Pertaining to my country, the Sudan, I have to be honest and tell you frankly that we have inherited a state from the British. And until the 9th of January 2005, when we have signed the CPA, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, we have failed to change the state into a nation. The CPA has changed our country from a state to a nation in which all the Sudanese, they find themselves. We have shared power, we have shared wealth, and we have made the historical reconciliation of Africa. And we have taught Africans how to resolve conflicts by negotiations. In our opinion, and I think this is the opinion of most of the Africans, the CBA, it is one of the most important documents in the history of Africa. And we have stopped the longest war in Africa. These are our achievements. And I want to tell everybody that we want peace. We deserve peace. And we will work for peace. And we are ready to cooperate with any country, with the United Nations, for peace to be sustainable in my country, Sudan. There is no question about that. Our connection with UNIMIS, our connection with UNIMID are quite evident that the Sudanese people at large, they are for peace. We have no problem with the international community if they want to help the Sudanese to reach sustainable peace in their country, either in the south or in Darfur. In my opinion, the problem of Darfur, it started as a local problem, but it was later on hijacked by certain international bodies, and now it is labeled as an international crisis. We accept that. We want your solution. We want your contribution to resolve the conflict in Darfur. We are ready. We are fully-fledged, open to receive any suggestion how to resolve the conflict in Darfur. We have really accepted the mediation of the international community at the time of the war with the South, and we came to the conclusion, the CBA. Now we want to conclude another DBA. We have already concluded Darfur peace agreement 3 years back. The Americans, they were witnessing that, the British, the international community, the United Nations, the African Union, they were all witnesses. Now, the DBA was thrown in the garbage. We are ready to accept another DBA in Qatar, in Russia, at any place. We want peace in Darfur. I love when some people, they ask us to normalize our relations with Chad. We don't have any problem with Chad. We are cousins, in fact. But who will convince France? The problem is France. You see, I'm not a diplomat. I am a lawyer. And lawyers are always outspoken person. You see, I am a lawyer. I know how to defend my clients. My clients now are the poor people of Darfur. We don't have, I want to tell everybody here, we don't have any problem with Chad. We are cousins. But who will convince the French that we are cousins? This is a war by proxy. I really respect what has been said by our Swedish friend, who chairs now the EU. He spoke about implementation of the outstanding issues, between the CB, and I do agree with that. These issues are only three issues: demarcation of the frontiers, of the border between the north and the south, the elections, and the referendum. These are the only three issues. Then he spoke about conducive environment for the elections. I want just to answer him. Yes, conducive elections, environment for the election. It is going to be just conducive, just like what has happened in Afghanistan. It is conducive there for the international community, for the European Union. What is going on in Afghanistan, the election, although the ballot boxes were guarded by the Marines, but it is a conducive environment. Yes, we'll have our elections, as well as, just like what has happened in Afghanistan. Is there any problem? We have a precedent now, what is going on in Afghanistan. Pertaining to the ICC, what he has said, it is outdated. It is out of fashion. It is not acceptable to Africa and the Arab world. Imagine that he wants the Sudanese to cooperate with ICC to take our president to The Hague to be tried there. This is a child wouldn't have passed. Something like that. You see, Mr. Our French participant spoke about Darfur issue, and he said it is a humanitarian crisis. It is a humanitarian issue. This is why they are involving themselves in Darfur. I want to remind him of the Berlin Congress, which had been invited by Bismarck in 1884. Was it for humanitarian reason to be involved in Africa? And I want to remind him about the agreement of Paris in the 31st of March 1899. To divide the Nile, the influence on the Nile, Central Africa between France and England. Was it humanitarian? Gentlemen, I accept what you have said, but that was not the truth. It is not for humanitarian reason. It is for political reason. Let us be quite honest with ourselves. About the ICC, I am not going to speak very much because we, the Sudanese people, we are not going to allow any country to infringe our constitution. We are ready to protect our sovereignty. And just I will quote from the Bible. I will say justice might wait until the resurrection of Jesus. And let me quote for you what Jesus had said as quoted in the Bible. He said, the time is near. Let him who does wrong continue to do wrong. Let him who is vile continue to be vile. Let him who does right continue to do right. And let him who is holy continue to be holy. Behold, I am coming soon. Mm-hmm.
My reward is with me, and I will give everyone according to what he has done. I am the Alpha, I am the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. Thank you for listening.
Спасибо. Последним нашим выступающим перед.
And our last speaker before we break for coffee break will be Mr. Douglas Proudfoot from the Canadian Foreign Ministry Department.
Our host, Mr. Magulov, has billed this as a scientific and practical conference. That's a good thing. It'll be Tamar, not Nadwa. So I'll base my remarks on empirical observation. It's been pointed out that only Sudanese can bring peace to Sudan. Agree with that. The international community's role is a vital one, but it's a supporting role. But I'm concerned in that context about a number of threats to the security of that international presence, of the AU and UN presence, and of humanitarian personnel. There have been several references to the kidnappings, a number of NGO workers kidnapped, including two Canadians who have since been released, but there are still two NGO workers who remain as hostages, and two UN staff in unknown hands, and recently attacks on UNAMID personnel in which one was killed and several others wounded. And I think we have to keep our thoughts on them. Canada is increasingly concerned about Sudanese unity. We think that unity is the best option for Sudan. Canada has had threats to its own unity, threats we have survived. And we have a number of lessons learned from that, some positive, some negative, which we're willing to share, and some expertise on referenda experiences. We do think unity is the best option, but we don't see empirical evidence of a genuine effort to preserve unity, and time is short. Now, there should be no illusions about what an independence referendum means. And what I have to say on this is particularly, but not exclusively, for our friends in southern Sudan. A referendum is not the end of a process, it's the beginning of a process. It could be a process of secession, a process of secession which includes working for peaceful coexistence, because southern and northern Sudan are going to be neighbors no matter what happens. Or it can, as we hope, the process of further unity, of sharing a new democratic Sudan belonging to all its people. And what we do as an international community should be intended to preserve peace no matter what the outcome is. And many of the things that can help to foster unity can also help to diminish the risk of violence if unity does not survive. Finally, I had not intended to mention the ICC, but there have been multiple references to it, mainly by Sudanese speakers. It was suggested earlier this morning that the ICC had endangered humanitarian operations in Darfur. Let's be clear here. It was not the ICC which chose to expel 13 international NGOs and close several Sudanese NGOs. It was the government of Sudan. It was not the ICC which has attacked humanitarian operations and taken some hostage. It's people unknown. So let's, rather than debating the ICC, we could have an interesting philosophical debate about the balance between justice and peace, but that is a rather metaphysical debate. And our host has asked us to be scientific and practical. Let's therefore look to the future here and look to practical achievables, practical steps, which both the government of Sudan and the international community and the government of Southern Sudan and the rebel movements can achieve. One is fuller UNAMID deployment, fuller effective UNAMID deployment. And that means, among other things, full compliance with the Status of Forces Agreement by the government of Sudan. But it also means that the international community, particularly industrial countries, can provide additional voluntary support for UNAMID. Canada has provided helicopters, has provided most of the armored personnel carrier fleet. Those are being replaced, and Canada is buying new vehicles for a number of African troop contributing countries. And I would encourage other industrial countries which have not yet done so to think of ways of providing voluntary financial support for UNAMID. We can support also the Darfur peace process. We can intensify our dialogue with rebel movements and ensure that everything we do is in concert and coherent with the efforts of a single mediation led by Mr. Basley in Doha. We can encourage both the government of Sudan and the government of Southern Sudan to respect human rights and to implement the CPA fully in letter and in spirit, because as Dr. Ghazi reminded us this morning, that agreement is sacrosanct. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We have a coffee break. Please understand that now it is 26 past 4. In 10 minutes, we will start again. Thank you.
My pardon, honorable guests, I would like to make one more announce. If some of you likes to make some report for tomorrow's session, please don't hesitate to inscribe yourself at our reception desk. Many thanks for your attention.
Gentlemen, last minute call for all the participants. The plane is taking off.